Shrink Wrap Radio number 463, The Feeling Brain with Dr. Elizabeth Johnston.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Johnston of Sarah Lawrence College, and we'll be discussing the 2015 book she co-authored with Dr. Leah Olson, The Feeling Brain, The Biology and Psychology of Emotions. For more information about Dr. Elizabeth Johnston, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com.
One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview.
Dr. Elizabeth Johnston, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here, and I want to congratulate you on your new book, The Feeling Brain, The Biology and Psychology of Emotions. Boy, you and your co-author wrapped your arms around quite a bit of material there.
Yes, we certainly did. It began with a course that we co-taught. We both realized that there were a number of papers coming out that were relevant to this shift in affective neuroscience. More and more papers about emotion and memory, emotion and perception, emotion and attention, and so forth. And we realized that there was material that we could put together for a course. And so we taught it several times, and our goal was always to bring together a lot of different sorts of materials, because it is a very integrative subject. It lets you look at many subfields of psychology and of biology, and Leah and I have somewhat different backgrounds, and that fed into the dynamic. And it's also, we teach at this unique college, Sarah Lawrence, where there's a seminar and conference system where there's only small seminars, and then the professors meet individually with every student in the class on a regular schedule, and then they develop a longer project in that. So it was a really great environment to develop the course in. And after we'd taught it several times, an editor at Norton saw our syllabus online and contacted us and asked if we'd like to write a book.
How fortuitous.
Yes, it was. And we sort of naively said, oh, yes, we'll do that, and set a deadline of a couple of years later. And that was 5 years ago. So it was certainly, you know, a lot more than we had originally anticipated.
Oh, I can believe it.
And more material kept coming out all the time as we were doing the course and as we were writing the book. So we felt like that was our task, to integrate a whole lot of diverse material that pertained to this growth of affective neuroscience.
Yes. And by the way, before we got started on the interview here, I just want to share with the audience that I found out that you're from Scotland originally, and that's where the bit of, what would you call it, a brogue?
From. Yeah, I have a East of Scotland, Edinburgh accent.
It's delightful. Well, how did the two of you divide the work up? I'm always impressed by people who collaborate on a book, and I wonder how they arrange it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It evolved over time. So, you know, because we'd been teaching the course for several years, we thought it was going to be really easy to divide up the material and just, you know, have one of us write the first draft and go back and forth with the other, depending on, you know, our own subspecialties. But
yes,
as we worked on it, it evolved into a different sort of process, where we would, you know, one of us would draft it and then we'd rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. So some of the chapters especially, we ended up really overhauling such that the person who first drafted it had virtually nothing left of what they'd originally put in. So there was a huge amount of back and forth.
And do you two, are you still speaking with one another?
Absolutely, yeah. huge respect and affection for Leah. She's a very rigorous thinker, and that was great. That was really, she really kept us honest with a lot of stuff and really thinking things through and always bringing in new things. She's always finding new papers, new subject matter to enter in, and that was part of the reason that it took us so long.
Yeah, well, it's not surprising because you have, as I say, got your arms around a huge amount of material. And interestingly, you write that for a long time, the study of emotion was largely neglected in both biology and psychology. Why was that the case?
Yes, well, I think that in psychology, it was to do with this cognitive shift where, it was not during the behaviorist era, that was not really considered respectable to talk about inner mental states.
Especially. That's right. I remember that.
nebulous and quiet ones as emotions.
How the wheel turns. That's just amazing, because B.F. Skinner was so adamant and truculent on that point, and for a long time, people just fell in line with that way of thinking, and now it's just been exploded.
Yes, really, in the last couple of decades, it's... things have come out that are so much more reminiscent of an earlier period in psychology where emotion had an equal place with cognition and motivation, the trilogy of mind that we talk about. So it's really, in many ways, harking back to an older and more inclusive, more expansive psychology of William James, a foundational.
That's interesting. It makes me think that we sort of picked it apart and split it up to try to understand various areas in more depth. And now there's a process of putting it all back together again.
Yeah, it really feels like that. It feels like it's an extremely integrative subdiscipline. So in order to look at emotions in the brain, you have to look at their development, you have to look at social psychology, you have to look at cognition and perception, memory, attention, in terms of biology, you have to think about the evolutionary aspects of it. You have to think about the cellular mechanisms. You have to think about the regulation of life, something we talk about a lot, homeostasis, animal behavior. There's so many diverse subfields of both psychology and biology that you have to bring together in order to understand emotions, because they are these very integrative kinds of things.
Yeah, you were so brave to take it on, as I say, the whole ball of wax. Now, emotions, we all have them, and I think most of us assume we know what they are, but it turns out to be more complex than most of us realize. And you, too, open your book with the question of what is an emotion? And really, the rest of the book is devoted to answering that seemingly simple question. So you raise the question in the first chapter, and then you come back to it again in the final chapter. So let me ask you your first chapter level definition. What is an emotion?
Right. So that structure is actually based on something that we did in our course, where we asked students to write, before they read anything at all, we asked them to write what they thought about the subject, what is an emotion. And then we asked them to repeat that at the end of the class and write what is an emotion. So we were doing the same thing in our book that we had asked our students to do when we set up the class. And one of the first readings that we used was William James's 1884 essay, What is an Emotion? And there he's really arguing for this embodied view of emotions, that emotions consist of the perception of the bodily changes that come about. So he's taking a very physiological stance on what is an emotion, and he's really talking about feelings, what we perceive, how we understand the bodily changes. And he asks us to imagine an emotion without those bodily changes, without the racing heart and the flushed skin and the increased breathing rate and things like that. And he says, without those bodily symptoms of an emotion, it would be nothing. There wouldn't be any feeling or any value attached to it. Yeah. It wouldn't motivate us. It wouldn't be as all-encompassing. So we start from that idea of James's, which is the necessity of these of perception of the bodily changes in emotion.
Okay. And I, speaking of James, I seem to remember an old debate, which I think is resolved now, and it was recalled. I seem to remember from my graduate school days the James Lange theory. Do I have that right? Or debate?
Carl Lange was a Danish physiologist who had come up with a very similar kind of theory to William James. And so the James Lange theory was opposed by the Cannon Bard theory. So Walter Cannon had been a student of James's. And he, unlike James, didn't believe that these bodily changes were differentiated enough.
What was the thing about if you meet a bear in the woods?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's James's very famous example. So he says, imagine this situation. You meet a bear in the woods. You run. And then you experience these bodily symptoms, and only once you've done that do you have the feeling of the emotion. So the feeling comes about from perceiving these changes that have happened in your body.
One camp said you run because you're scared, and the other camp, I believe, said you're scared because you ran. Do I have that right?
That's right. So James would be in the second camp there. So he was arguing against this idea that there was some kind of mental state that's an emotion that motivated your running and that directed things. But he wanted to turn the logic around and say it's actually your perception of what happens when you respond to a fearful stimulus or a sad stimulus. Or
so what's our understanding of it today?
So it's more mixed, like everything. So, you know, James got part of it right, mm-hmm. in the sense that these bodily changes are vital for our perception of emotion. But James was really just talking about the feeling, the awareness of it, and not all of the biological response of the emotion. So James had an essential kernel, but didn't explain everything we want to be able to explain about an emotion. So, for example, we talk in chapter one about appraisal theories, which were more cognitive theories. How not everybody responds in exactly the same way to the same stimulus. You know, somebody who's a bear hunter may not be running.
Yeah. Good point.
Or somebody who sees a bear, you know, in a cage at the zoo is not going to be as afraid, things like that. So there's different ways in which we appraise emotional stimuli depending on our past experience with them and so forth. So James's account didn't take that into consideration as much as
later. Well, also due to, you know, subsequent findings in neuroscience, we know that messages, some of the messages bypass the cortex and go to the subcortical areas where responding is automatic without thought, and other fibers are going up to areas where we can kind of think about it or put it in context and remind ourselves, well, I'm a hunter here, and I have a gun and the bear doesn't.
Right. Yeah, you're talking there about the work of Joseph Ledoux, who was really an important figure in our thinking about this book. So he distinguishes between the low road and the high road to the amygdala. There's a quick, fast, dirty route that lets you quickly assess what's going on. So, you know, he has the example of if you see something while you're walking in the woods, and you immediately jump back thinking it might be a snake. But later on, with a more careful look at it, you see, oh, it's a rope or it's a twig or something like this.
That's happened to me many times.
Right. So he's pointing out that there are these two roads. One is this quick path that lets you make an assessment, a sort of better safe than sorry assessment. Watch out quickly, get out of the way. And then there's a much longer cortical route that is concerned with closer analysis of the stimulus to see. But basic survival mechanisms are really a large part of an emotional response. And they're always following this kind of better safe than sorry idea that you don't want to wait around and weigh all your options and analyze things and, you know, from every perspective and think about everything. In fact, emotions make you want to act quickly.
Yes. Now, in addition to stepping back for a look at William James, you went even further back to Charles Darwin.
Yes.
What does Charles Darwin have to say to us about the role of emotion?
So Darwin really focused on emotional expression and the communication of emotions, the way that animals have evolved to convey emotions and intentions to others through those emotional expressions. So we did some reading in our course from his book about the expression of emotions in man and animals. And he's making the same argument you see in other pieces of his work, that emotions are functional, that they convey an evolutionary advantage to organisms because of their ability to communicate things through emotional expressions. And one of the things that we wrote about there was the ability of different species to read emotions from facial expressions, from body language, and so forth.
Yes, yeah, so how many emotions are there? can we count them or not?
Well, it depends who you ask, right? So initially, Paul Ekman, who was very inspired by Darwin's writings, talked about six, and he and his co-workers became very well known for their cross-cultural studies, where they took images of posed basic emotional expressions like anger, fear, happiness, sadness, surprise, disgust were the six that they looked at, and they found that people in a range of different countries, some of them considered less developed, more rural and isolated, were still able to identify which expression was being posed by these actors.
Cross-culturally,
at a better than chance level. So it was better for some of them than others. Like happiness was well recognized, but other ones like surprise and fear were sometimes confused, and disgust and fear were sometimes confused, things like that. But there was an impressive ability to identify basic emotions from facial expressions in a whole range of cultures that he looked at. People have questioned that later on. Have questioned that work and, you know, the way it's set up. And there are some other results that suggest it's not always so easy, and that the emotions are often complex mixtures rather than these very discrete responses.
That seems to be the path of psychology. Something gets established and then somebody comes along and unestablishes it.
That does happen quite frequently.
Yes, yes. Now, are some emotions more basic than others?
Right. So people have argued that. And certainly you can look at that developmentally, that there are earlier emotions to develop, and some social emotions take longer. You know, things like shame takes longer to develop than fear, which is a very immediate kind of response. So you can say that some develop earlier than others.
Yeah, I think earlier you mentioned Joe Ledoux.
Yes.
And he kind of argues for the primacy of fear, right?
He's done a lot of investigations. His really brilliant work tracing the fear pathway and showing that the amygdala is a crucial structure, crucial subcortical structure that allows you to basically be fear conditioned, to learn fear. That was one of the important early studies in affective neuroscience, establishing the primacy of something like fear. So he's very convincing in his analysis of these survival circuits that he talks about. And he's done a lot of work on the relationship between fear and anxiety. He's about to produce a book about anxiety. I think it's coming out next month.
Uh-huh. And where does Jack Panksepp's work fit in here?
Yeah, so Panksepp is another person who's argued for this idea of these ancestral tools for living, these survival mechanisms that are core, that are built in. And Panksepp has been somebody who's insisted that these are shared across species, that they're basic and they're necessary for for maintaining life. So, you know, they are systems like fear and rage, and seeking is one of his elementary systems, that the motivational system that he links to dopamine, that's so crucial in his thinking. He also has systems that are to do with care and care of offspring. Lust is another of his systems. He started with seven.
Yeah, those seem like really important ones to take into account.
Yeah,
you know, caring for others and mm-hmm. lust. Definitely an important part of the emotional mix.
Yeah, grief and panic, or that's another system of his, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you raise the question of, you know, what purpose do emotions serve? And one of the main purpose that we've been alluding to here is that somehow they serve survival. Is there more to say about the purpose that emotions serve?
Yes, we found that was a common theme in a lot of the different emotion theorists that we looked at. So even researchers who are more concerned with the neuroimaging and neurology, people like Antonio Damasio and Bud Craig, all of these accounts, Panksepp's, Ledoux's, Craig's, Damasio's, all stress these basic homeostatic mechanisms, this idea that emotions are about regulating the body and the integrity of the body, integrating internal and external stimuli in an optimal way to respond to all of the challenges in living.
And tell us more about Damasio's work. I actually had a chance to interview some of the people we've been talking about, like Ekman, Panksepp, Ledoux, but not Damasio.
Right. His work is really important in thinking about the relationship between emotion and cognition. So in his book, Descartes' Error, he talks about a patient of his that he sees as a kind of modern-day Phineas Gage. And, you know, Phineas Gage is the very famous early case study of somebody who had an iron tamping rod go through his skull and destroy a large portion of his frontal cortex, and the effects that that had on his personality and his social connections and the way he lived.
Yes.
So Damasio talks about an unfortunate patient who had a tumor that destroyed his ventromedial prefrontal cortex, so that frontal cortex, you know, just above the eye sockets, damaged by the tumor, which was removed, but the damage was still there. And he had previously been, you know, a very effective businessman with a secure family life, and he retained a lot of his abilities, his cognitive abilities, his intellectual abilities, but he just completely lost his moorings at work. He would start tasks and never be able to finish them, even though his knowledge of what he was doing was intact. His family split up. He made a series of disastrous financial decisions. He remarried quickly, somebody that all of his friends and family thought was unsuitable. They were divorced a few months later. He couldn't keep a job. His life fell apart, even though in many ways it seemed like he was intact, you know, that he was able to talk and walk and think and engage in conversation with Damasio quite readily and so forth, and do all sorts of tasks, but he turned out to be really lacking in the ability to feel emotions, to assign value to things. So he'd be given a task to make a decision about, and he would be able to lay out all the possibilities, but he wouldn't be able to decide.
That gets at something important
yeah.
that you highlight in your book, that emotion has a role to play in judgment.
In decision-making, yes, that kind of value or gut instinct, if you like, that feeling that this is the right course of action, is a vital function of emotion and decision-making. It's not this separation between rationality and feeling, but that they are integrally interconnected. And this is what Damasio's patient Elliot showed so clearly. And Damasio formulated this idea, the somatic marker hypothesis, which was this idea that Elliot and other patients like him with damage to the ventromedial prefrontal cortex were lacking these bodily signals that were so vital to feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a Jamesian kind of theory. That it is these bodily signals, that the perception of the bodily signals that is so helpful.
And so what about that gut feeling? We sometimes yeah. make decisions based on a gut feeling.
Right. And Damasio was able to show that this was missing for Elliot and is missing for a lot of patients with this kind of thing. And he did it with this task in collaboration with his wife, Hannah Damasio, and Antoine Beccara, a longtime collaborator of Damasio's. They devised this Iowa gambling task. It was called Iowa because they were based in Iowa at that time. And it was a way of measuring the ability to make advantageous decisions, in this case, financial decisions, with the gambling task. And they were able to show that Elliot was missing the kinds of signals, bodily signals. They were skin conductance responses in anticipation of selecting from the bad decks, the ones that would ultimately give less payoff, although they gave high immediate reward. And Elliot and other patients were unable to generate these anticipatory signals that kept them away from the bad decks, the kind of bodily sign or the gut instinct, oh, I shouldn't make that choice. That over time, that hasn't worked out well, even though I might immediately get a good reward, the punishment is going to add up to more later.
And another topic that you bring up in this connection is hedonics. you know, which related to the word hedonism. So where does our sense of the feeling of pleasure or come in decision making? And
right. So again, this is another case of the value that's placed on things by emotion. So Kent Berridge and a number of his co-workers talk about the hedonic gloss that's painted onto sensation, this idea that there's processing of the sensory factors, like the sensory aspects of the taste and flavor of food that you eat. And in addition to those sensory aspects, there is something that is assigning value or positive value to that. And this is related to Panksepp's way of thinking about affect, this idea that affect is basically a valence. It's, do I want to approach this? Do I want to avoid it? Is it positive? Is it negative? So hedonics is that valuing, that painting on of the positive or the negative.
Mm-hmm.
And Berridge and his group had a very clever behavioral way of measuring these responses. So for the liking, for the pleasure, they would look at the lip licking that was done by rats. They did a lot of their studies in rats, but it's done by all kinds of organisms. And then they would use mouth gapes, the kind of opening to indicate displeasure or disgust to bitter taste. And early on, that's to the response to sweet taste is the lip licking, and the response to bitter taste is the gape. So they had this behavioral way of looking at the differences in value of the kinds of stimuli that they were presenting to them. And then they were able to use micro-injections of chemicals into the brain to enhance or decrease those responses and structures that are part of the reward system, the nucleus accumbens, the ventral striatum, ventral pallidum, and trace the pathways of response for hedonics. So Berridge, like Ledoux, is able to, you know, take a behavioral operationalization of something emotional and then trace the neural pathways involved in that. And that's really the essence of affective neuroscience, being able to move from that behavior to how can this be affected by these changes in the brain.
Yeah, well, the specificity and detail that they're able to get to is quite amazing. Now, something that would not have occurred to me is if I were to sit down and think about the role of emotion and the various functions that it plays in our mental life is that is the role of emotions in our sense of self.
Yes.
That would not have occurred to me. Tell us a bit about that.
So for me, that comes in most clearly with Bud Craig's work, where he's talking about the insula, this island of cortex that is involved in sensing the body or interception, sensing the physiological state of the body. And he ties those bodily feelings and emotional feelings and other types of feelings, like the feeling that you know a word but you can't produce it, that's the feeling that it's on the tip of your tongue, which you might call a more cognitive kind of feeling or a feeling of knowing.
Yeah.
So he sees this pathway which has its primary cortical landing spot in the insula as integrating all kinds of affective bodily sensations, pain and temperature and muscle ache, thirst and hunger, all of these bioregulatory mechanisms are represented in maps in the insula. And that is a structure where these maps of different bodily sensations, these labeled lines or somatotopic maps, are integrated with information from other sensory systems, from regions like the amygdala, from other frontal regions, to produce what he calls a global emotional moment. So how you feel in all aspects at that moment in time, a kind of feeling working memory, if you like, and that's a sense of self. So his two papers that became very well known that were published in Nature Neuroscience Reviews, the first one was called How Do You Feel? And the second one was called How Do You Feel Now? So this idea of when somebody asks you that, how do you feel? You're assessing all of these different systems. You're bringing all of these things together, your history with things, what you're expecting, how you're feeling in different aspects of your body. And you come up with some sense of how you feel at that moment in time. And that's the sentient self that he talks about. It's based on Charles Sherrington's idea of the material me.
Of the what me?
The material me.
The material
me. Both had to have these alliterative monikers to refer to it. And Sherrington is the person who coined the term interoception, this sensing of the body, sensing of the internal milieu. And Craig took it further and said it's much more specific than people used to think. People used to think these were kind of vague and crude visceral sensations that we experienced as a result of stimulation of the insula. But Craig was able to, through, again, very rigorous and careful mapping and anatomical tracing methods, to show these multiple maps and the importance of integrating information from all aspects of the body.
Yes.
To our state of feeling.
So going back to the example that you gave of having something on the tip of your tongue, but you can't quite recall it. Mm-hmm. So with the fact that I've got emotional fibers running mm-hmm. through the insula, along with various kinds of things related to memory and so on, might that have something to do with that difficulty that if I'm self-conscious, I'm going to have a harder time thinking of a name?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So the thing that's interesting in that phenomenon is that strong sense that you do know it. That's the feeling.
It drives you nuts.
And emotions are like that. They're not something that you can just cast aside. They come over you, and they motivate you to act. They're intense, and so that you get very frustrated by that. And especially as you get older, people get very upset about their inability to recall words at particular times.
Well, you're describing my experience perfectly.
Mine too.
I find that, sometimes I'll say, okay, well, let's just forget about it for now, mm-hmm. and I'm sure I'll remember in a bit. Yes. And sure enough, a few minutes go by, and boom, it'll pop into my mind.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting phenomenon, that idea that if you ruminate or if you perseverate, that you can't get a hold of the thing that you want to actually get a hold of, and that what is often needed is a breaking of the attention away from that search that's going nowhere.
Yes.
And that ability to regulate attention is absolutely crucial to emotion regulation. That it's the flexibility that you need to stop persisting with one way of doing things, because what's often happening is you're producing partial cues. Like, you can remember things like the first letter or the number of syllables or something it sounds like, or you can see the face of the person if you're trying to come up with the name. But you're getting stuck on these cues that end up interfering with your ability to actually recall the word. And so by breaking away from it, from removing your attention from it, you actually allow the possibility for other cues to prompt it. Because memory is all about cueing, retrieval cues.
Yeah, and as you talk about the role of attention and the ability to move and control your attention to some degree, that gets me thinking about meditation and mindfulness and those sorts of topics.
Yes. Yes, you might have noticed that we do mention that several times throughout the text, and that's something that came up in a lot of different contexts for us, that many people were suggesting some form of mindfulness meditation, some form of attention regulation as a way of regulating emotions.
Yeah, that was one of the questions that you raise in your book, is can we control our emotions? And so maybe we should just go there since it's come up.
Okay.
Can we control our emotions? I think we're suggesting that maybe we can. And if so, what are some of the strategies for the self-regulation of our emotions?
Well, one of the things that I think was really notable to us in reading the literature is how many different ways there are of changing emotion. So emotion regulation is defined as being able to alter the way you feel about something voluntarily, the explicit emotion regulations. And this is the work of James Gross and many, many colleagues at Stanford. So they produce a model which has a very impressive array of different kinds of strategies for regulating emotions. You know, some of them are attentional, some of them are regulating the physiological aspects. Some of them are reappraisal or reframing, thinking about things differently in order to change how you feel about things. And there's just an impressive array. There's also ones that are not as explicit, but are more implicit, which is in some ways kind of easier to train. Sometimes the explicit emotion regulation strategies are hard to make habitual.
I'm not sure I'm following the difference between the implicit and the explicit strategies.
Okay.
Maybe you could give us an example of each.
Sure, sure. So the explicit ones are ones where you're deciding to do things differently. So, you know, when a therapist asks a patient to reframe something in therapy, they're using an explicit emotion regulation strategy. And it can be hard for the person out of the context of the therapeutic situation to have that come to mind when a situation arises that's very distressing to them, for example. They would have to kind of stop and think, oh, I need to think about this situation differently. I have to reframe it and, you know, think about, you know, did the other person really intend to upset me with what they said? Or is this terrible thing that I'm anticipating really going to happen? But it can be hard to, in the moment, change how you're thinking about something with reappraisal, with that kind of explicit strategy. An implicit strategy would be something that comes about without you necessarily intending to control it. And sometimes that happens just in terms of the situation you set up for yourself. So some of the kind of strategies that Matthew Lieberman talks about in his work in connection with what he calls the brain's braking system, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, are implicit strategies. So that it turns out that if you do things like control motor movements, that can have an effect on your experience of emotions. So, you know, things like learning music can be really beneficial for motor control,
sure.
That can overlap in terms of emotional control too, so that he sees all of these control mechanisms as related to each other. And that, for example, when teachers or parents tell children to use their words. Just the act of saying how they're feeling can change how they're feeling. Can give them a little bit of perspective and distance. Just naming it makes them less agitated, things like that.
Yeah, good. One of the questions that you raised in the book is what distinguishes emotions from other mental states. I'm not sure if we've already addressed that or not.
Right. So that's when you ask this question, what is an emotion? That's an obvious way to think about it. How are emotions different from cognitions or perceptions or other types of how is it different from thinking? And one of the things that we found over the course of our research for the book is that they're often integrated. They're not so separate.
Right.
So,
you can't really separate them out, can you?
Right. So emotion and thinking are, you know, feeling and rationality are not opposites, but they are intertwined with each other, necessary for each other. So when I've been talking about emotion regulation strategies, I've been talking sometimes about how thinking changes emotion. How if you think about something differently, you change how you feel. And then earlier we were talking about how feeling is necessary for decision making, for judgments. So that interaction of the two, you find all through the literature. So some of the studies that we look at in terms of perception show that you can literally see more if you are more emotionally aroused. So, seeing fearful faces, even if they're presented subliminally, so that you can't, if too rapidly for you to see them, make it easier for you to detect the orientation of lines of grating shown afterwards. So your senses can become more acute through emotional arousal, emotional stimulation, even if you weren't aware of the source of that stimulation.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the feeling of being in love, of infatuation.
Your
perceptual fields just open up and everything is, you see more, you feel more, it's all more lively.
Yes. And that's true of other emotions too. So I write about that example where I met somebody just as I was about to take my dog for a walk in the woods who said to me that he thought there was a bear in the woods. And I decided to go on another trail than the one that he'd been on, but to go for the walk anyway, since my dog was eager and already there. But I had this huge heightening of my sensory perception. I heard every tiny little crack of a stick, and I felt like my field of vision was much wider than it really is. My hearing was so acute. And that's one of the ways that emotions work with other things like perception and attention. And with memory too, you know, because I would be remembering reports in the paper of bear sightings.
And the other way around, in depression, and how one's perception, one's range of thinking, of seeing the options, and the whole coloration of experience becomes dark and depressed.
Right, and there's a kind of lack of pleasure and anhedonia, a lack of motivation and inability to flexibly reappraise or, you know, think about things differently. There's a kind of a stickiness or a sludginess to the thinking that comes about through that emotional change.
Yes. Now some people sort of isolate an emotional system, referring to the emotional brain. Talk to us a little bit about that. Do we have an emotional brain?
Yeah, so that's a really great question that we definitely addressed. And it can be traced to the thinking most prominently of Paul MacLean and his idea of the triune brain that we have, a lower reptilian brain, mm-hmm. and then a middle limbic system, mammalian brain that is emotional. And then on top of that, we have this neocortex that's the higher, more rational structure. And sometimes the way that he talked about these three brains in one was a kind of layering or a modular approach, almost like Russian dolls where they'd be stacked inside each other.
Right.
And the middle Russian doll is the emotional brain in his account, the limbic system, that's, you know, at the border of these subcortical, lower subcortical structures and higher cortical structures. And it is true that a lot of the structures that we talk about are in these medial regions, and you know, things like the amygdala, the anterior cingulate cortex, that band right above the corpus callosum, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex we already talked about, that there are a lot of these medial hidden structures that are important in emotional processing. But the more you study emotions in the brain, the more areas are involved and the larger and larger that system has to be. And it's not isolated. It's not as though, you know, there's a structure that deals with a certain emotion. Like early on in some of the neuroimaging studies, people thought that you could equate fear with the amygdala and disgust with the insula, and the orbital frontal cortex with anger, things like this, that there would be a module for each emotion that would light up to indicate that emotion. So I don't know if you've seen this this wonderful movie, Inside Out.
I have not. Is it really wonderful? I know it's been well reviewed, and I thought, well, I don't know, it sounds a little hokey.
There are parts that are a little hokey, but it's brilliantly conceived. But it does have this. It does have a character for each emotion, mm-hmm. you know, as though they're separate. But one of the resolutions of the story is that the emotions can't be a single emotion that's in control. They have to interact with each other. So, you know, the 11-year-old girl is happiness, Amy Poehler's in control the whole time. But then lots of other things keep happening that mean the other emotions and their functions have to come into play. And it ends up being a combination of happiness and sadness.
Do you think you'll end up assigning that film to students?
I could definitely see that. There are very interesting ways in which it does mirror some of the ideas that we talk about in the book, and there are ways in which it clearly departs from them. So I think, you know, for example, they have long-term memories represented by these sort of snow globes that contain all the information about an event, and they're differently colored, and the color indicates which emotion is associated with that one particular long-term memory. So the reason I started talking about this is that they do present this kind of modular view of emotions and memories and brain functions. And that's very much what we were arguing against in the book, that it's not this system where you divide up the brain into emotional regions and non-emotional regions, or regions that just deal with fear versus regions that just deal with anger, but that multiple emotions are processed in the same region, and a single emotion is processed in multiple regions, and the ways in which the networks interact with each other are what's most important.
Let's see, somebody we haven't spoken about in relation to memory and the role of memory and the experience of emotion, vice versa, and somebody that you talk about that I was not familiar with is James McGaw. Is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about his work.
So one of the crucial insights that McGaw had was looking at the effect of arousal and the stress hormones on memories. So he did his studies early on with rats, looking at the their ability to avoid foot shock and, you know, the recall of that, and how it could be potentiated by injections of substances that increase things like epinephrine after the learning, after the initial trial where the shock was paired with that particular environment. And he was able to show the relationship between the amygdala and other structures like the hippocampus, where the, in effect, the amygdala sort of acted like a volume dial or an amplification of effects in the hippocampus, which is more associated with laying down the memory of the context. And he was able to really trace some of the neurochemistry of that and how it depended on noradrenergic systems. And he was able to show through things like blocking those systems that where the learning became worse, or amplifying the learning through amping up those systems. And his work really made that connection, the way that we tend to remember things that have emotional salience or value to us, explicit in more physiological terms.
Okay, well, there's so much more in your book that we could touch upon, because the topic just reaches out everywhere. I'd like to ask you kind of a personal question. Assume that nothing happens by chance for a moment, if you can, thinking back to yourself as a girl in Scotland growing up. I'm wondering if there's anything in your experience that comes to mind as to why emotion would be such a strong area of interest in your adult life.
Oh, yeah.
Is it okay to ask that?
Yes, of course. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think there's several things at play here. So one of them is I'm a fairly anxious person. And so I've been always interested how that has come about.
And yeah.
That's something that's present in a number of members of my family. So ways of dealing with anxiety definitely interest me. And a lot of the material that we cover in the book is about the mechanisms of anxiety, what's different.
And did you, in the process, discover anything that's potentially helpful to you in that regard?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's very helpful to think about all of the different ways in which you can manage anxiety, all of the different emotion regulation mechanisms. And I do have a yoga practice I've had for many years. And for me, the practice of mindfulness is really situated in that.
Uh-huh.
So I always was interested in kind of grounding myself in the bodily movements. So I practice yoga and meditation not to kind of escape from the body, but to come back to it much more and get out of my mind and ruminative thoughts and perseverations about things. So that's one of the reasons that I was really interested in this work. Another is that I have a background in perceptual psychology, and I was interested in the relationship between emotion and perception. So I teach a different course about art and visual perception, and I've been, you know, long been intrigued by what we find engaging, moving, when we look at artworks. So
are you an artist as well?
I am not. I come from an artistic family. So my dad's an architect, my sister's an architect, my brother's a furniture designer. So a lot of interest in design. I was surrounded by that. And I grew up somewhere very beautiful too, you know, just with the sea in sight. And I've always been very attuned to that.
Okay. Well, as we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I think we've covered a lot.
Well, good. I think we did too. And so, Dr. Elizabeth Johnston, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, the big takeaway for me is how complexly our emotions are interwoven in the brain with other neural processes, such as perception, cognition, motor behavior, among others. Also, our systems are far more distributed than any simple model of exclusive brain centers that we might hope for. Certainly, it would be easier if we could say we have definitively located the center for this or that in the brain. What seems to be the case is that our various brain functions are complexly interwoven through a variety of neural structures. One of the things you heard us speak about are those tip-of-the-tongue words that sometimes prove so elusive in the moment. There was one point in the discussion where it suddenly seemed relevant to me to ask about the role of the vagus system in what we were discussing, but I couldn't for the life of me remember the word vagus. I had associations such as oxytocin and Jack Paxup, both of which are relevant, at least in my mind. We decided to erase my stumbling around from the recording. Of course, as soon as we'd hung up, I remembered the word vagus. Well, that's how it goes, and seemingly more and more. If you're a serious student of the brain and or emotions or interested in the new and growing field of affective neuroscience, then this is the book for you. The title, once again, is The Feeling Brain, The Biology and Psychology of Emotions by Drs. Elizabeth Johnston and Leah Olson, and it's published by Norton. And as always, you're encouraged to order it using the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. And in so doing, we will get a small percentage of the price. In fact, you can order everything you order from Amazon, not just books, using our widget. And that's another way you can help to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi there. This is Ingrid greeting you from Copenhagen, Denmark. I've pressed the now multicolored donate button because at any time, anywhere I choose, I can listen to the most interesting psychological deep wisdom podcasts. It is just like sunshine to a troubled mind. And now I feel wiser and more dangerous. European co-listeners, Shrink Wrap Radio, sailing to you from over there in a nice pace with friendly Captain David on board. All for free. I'm only happy to set the sails.
Thank you, Ingrid from Copenhagen. Synchronistically, one of my adult sons is there on business as I record this. I have to say I'm jealous of him. Ingrid, if I ever do make it to Copenhagen, maybe you and I can get together over coffee or something so I can say thank you in person. Today was a red letter day because we got two new donors. Sylvie Berut in Switzerland, and Katie Hall, and I'm not sure where Katie hails from. Thanks, Sylvie and Katie and Ingrid, and I hope others will be inspired to follow your good examples and get their names on the honor roll on our site. We have two new transcripts on the site, and they are number 449, Inside the Criminal Mind with Stanton Samenow, Ph.D., thanks to Paula Bautista, who has transcribed a number of episodes for us recently. And then we have a transcript of number 438, Exploring a Relational Approach to Autism and Other States of Mind with Dr. Dan L. Edmonds, and that's thanks to Dick Nye. We have a new affiliate sponsor, DreamHost. I know some of you must have websites or be thinking about having a website or even starting a podcast. I think one of the very distinctive things about DreamHost is that they can host your content very economically in the cloud. Beyond this, DreamHost is a global hosting and cloud services company with over 400,000 entrepreneur and developer customers. They've got 1.3 million blogs, websites, and apps that are hosted. DreamHost offers a wide range of web services, including shared hosting, virtual private servers, dedicated server hosting, domain name registration, and so on. Lots of other services as well. Now, you can get one free domain name registration by clicking on the blinking DreamHost banner in our left-hand sidebar and then using my special discount code on signout. And my code in this case is just shrinkwrap, one word, and wrap is spelled just R-A-P, not W-R-A-P. So S-H-R-I-N-K-R-A-P. Finally, any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, let me recommend a book about the brain that I think you'll enjoy, inasmuch as today's book is not up there. Now, I heard about this book from past guest and friend John Arden, who wrote The Brain Bible. Well, he recommended to me Grain Brain, The Surprising Truth About Wheat, Carbs, and Sugar, Your Brain's Silent Killers. I haven't read it yet, but John recommends it, and it's been getting a lot of play. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, there are another 180,000 titles there for you to choose from if you'd like to try something else.
Hi, this is homeopath and naturopath Dr. Christopher Soten, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Christopher Soten, who was my guest on episode number 337. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just two, and the first one is from Mike, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, I just downloaded the Shrink Wrap Radio app. I must say, it's great. I would encourage everyone who listens to get this app. I'm very impressed with how user-friendly it is and the ability to download your favorite episodes straight to your device. Great job, Dr. Dave, and keep up the great work, Mike." Hey, Mike, I really appreciate that feedback, and I hope you put a recommendation, a review on the site where you downloaded it. And this reminds me to kind of recommend the app to everyone. I join in with Mike and encourage you to go to the apps tab on our site. Next, we hear from Susan, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a Jungian analyst in San Francisco. I love your show. I am semi-retired now, not seeing patients, taking lots of art classes. I listen to the show while painting. I also suggest many of the shows to my students at the Jung Institute. It's a great thing you are doing. Keep up the good work. I'd like to suggest Jungian analyst Erel Shalit. He's written 5 books, lives in Israel, and co-authored the book on dream amplification with Nancy Ferlotti, whom you have interviewed. He is a lovely, articulate guy with so much wisdom. He is one of our best intellectuals and analysts." And she gives me his web address at www.erelshalit.com. Warm regards, Susan. Well, Susan, as synchronicity would have it, today's interview was, in fact, with Nancy Ferlotti, whom you referenced in your email to me. And I believe Erel Shalit was the organizer of the conference on the Jung-Neumann correspondence, which Nancy and I discussed today. So I think it's a good suggestion you've made. It means a lot to me to have you as a regular listener, and I appreciate your spreading the word to your students at the San Francisco Jung Institute. By the way, Susan included a link to her art on the web, And I must say, it's quite wonderful. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. You can also contact me using the app that we spoke of just a little bit earlier. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Elizabeth Johnston, for her insights into the new field of affective neuroscience. My next interview will be with California-based counselor Beth Hossfeld, who is co-founder and consultant at One Circle Foundation, which focuses on promoting healthy relationships for children, adolescents, and families. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.